Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is May 12th, 2009, and this is episode 307. We have a fantastic program ahead tonight, so I'm going to keep this real short. I have a million things banging around in my head. Some of them will appear on blog. I finally bit the bullet and signed up for Twitter, but you'll see some things on there this coming week. Some will get held up in various stages of writing and research, but I want to remind everyone, try independent thinking this week. Independent thinking is a great thing. It leads even to more great things. So, now that I've signed up for Twitter this week, does that make me a social twit? I'll see what we think. I'll try using it for a couple weeks and see how it goes. I'm not sure yet exactly what I think at all, but everybody's doing the Twitter thing. Anyhow, if you want to, you can follow me at Gia Scott on Twitter, find out what I had for lunch and what harebrained ideas I'm entertaining for the hour. I'm also on Facebook, and then there's the blogs. All of these things can be found on the exogenynetwork.com website. That's exogenynetwork.com. My big wow of the day was seeing how Google's new browser works. It's called Chrome, and my mouth fell open at the speed it would load a graphic-heavy web page. It's not on my computer yet, but it will be before I log off tonight. Now, as for our guest tonight, his website had me reading intensely, and there's way too much information to even read. We could give it all to you in the next 2 hours. But we're going to learn a lot about Dr. John L. Turner and what his book is all about. So I would like to welcome him to the Dawn of Shades. Dr. Turner, would you please be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience, tell them a little bit about yourself, your website, and where your book is found.
Well, yes, good evening, Gia, and all listening. I appreciate the chance to be here, and I'm in Hawaii, kind of afternoon here, 2:14 in the afternoon, so an easy day here. And I hope everyone is doing well on the mainland. My book that you introduced is called Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. And I think it can be found almost anywhere in bookstores and online, but it deals with universal energy and my experiences as a neurosurgeon in Hawaii. I was the first neurosurgeon to come to Hawaii in 1981, actually some time ago, 28 years ago to be exact. And a lot of experiences opened up for me here, and to say why, I think it's because of the spiritual nature of Hawaii, and that I was on a quest to really look for the spiritual world. That's how I got into neurosurgery, and eventually that's how I got to Hawaii. So as you mentioned, there's a lot on a website devoted to the book, which is johnlturner.com, and you'll see the great work of the webmaster, Martin Simmons, who unfortunately passed away in February of this year. And after his passing, he did have some contact with me, so I hope this will be something I can share with your listeners tonight.
That sounds interesting, too. So, whatever made you decide to write a book about medicine, miracles, and manifestation?
It was, I have to say, synchronicity, and it had to do with running the I Ching. And as everyone knows, the runes in the I Ching are the ancient fortune-telling ways, and one day I had a computerized version of the Chinese I Ching, the Book of Changes, and I decided to run it for the first time, and I sat there, and the question I posed was, am I on the right path? Well, it was the answer to that that made me decide to write a book, and it had to do with potential, great potential, and a warning about arrogance. And it was such an involved and interesting reading that I felt compelled to start jotting down my experiences for my benefit, but also that others may see what I was going through and maybe will give them some insight. It's about spiritual pathways and different ways to obtain what I would call the apex of the tree of life. And it's a story about what happened, and then my discussion today will be about what I found out and what I feel the true path actually is. So it was the I Ching, the Book of Changes, that made me decide to write this book.
Yeah, I think that's a very common quest among people, no matter where they live, no matter what their occupation in life is, no matter what their level of education is. You sort of wonder, you know, what is my path in life? You know, how do I find what I really should be doing? I've listened to friends over the years. You know, it's a real common theme that you hear often.
Well, I tried many pathways, Gia, and I tried to devote about a year to each one. Things I mention in the book and things that I don't mention, such as A Course in Miracles, what it's like to go through a born-again Christian experience, various things, trying to show me, point me to the way of what this is all about and the meaning of life, death, and life after death. And as the only neurosurgeon on this island, which is called the Big Island because it's twice as big as all the Hawaiian islands put together, and Hilo, where I live, is the second largest city in Hawaii, Honolulu being the first, and also being around 50 minutes away on a 727 jet plane. So they never had anyone here to help them with head injuries and other types of neurological trauma. So there was a great need to be here, but also I needed Hawaii. I need a place to spiritually evolve and allow me to look for this search that I had for the spiritual world. And that began, by the way, with Edgar Cayce and the book The Sleeping Prophet, because before reading that book or hearing about the book, I thought I would get a PhD in physics. I had a bachelor's of science degree in engineering physics and had done all the coursework for the PhD. And then someone handed me that book, and it was like a wake-up call. I wanted to know how in the world could someone download all this information from the invisible dimension or spiritual world and have a cure rate of 85% with patients looking for a cure from dis-ease. And I divide that word up into two parts, dis-ease, because Edgar Cayce also added a lot of information about how to work with karmic implications with their disease. So that's what led me to Hawaii and led to the book.
Uh-huh. It's a much more interesting journey than originally I came from Arizona, the southwestern desert, and now I live in New Orleans. And when the first person predicted that I was going to go to move to New Orleans, I laughed and said, "Okay, why?" I lived in a very remote area. I was definitely not a city person, not even a town person, and I had no desire to move to a hot, humid climate. I hate humidity. And I've now lived here nearly 6 years.
Well, you plan to stay there?
Pardon?
You plan to stay there, of course, right?
Well, not necessarily. Sometimes you never know where life's journeys will take you, and I'm not going to wait for pigs flying anymore, I guess, you know, I'd say.
No, I know what you're saying. You know, my feeling is, Gia, that we have very little choice in the matter how our life unfolds. And that brings us to the subject of free will, something that I've written about and something that's being investigated a lot now in the scientific community, because there's some evidence that points to the fact that we are following a pre-programmed path, and that whatever free will we have may be a very small amount. So I think what led you from Arizona to New Orleans was the way it was supposed to be, obviously, or it wouldn't have happened. But not much you can do about it. That's my feeling.
Well, the way I look at it is I had some things I needed to learn. I wasn't going to be able to learn them in the boondocks of Arizona. I needed to come here. If anybody had told me even 5 years ago that I'd be sitting here doing this interview on this network and it'd be broadcasting all over the world on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, I would have laughed at them. I've done a fair amount of public speaking, but I always preferred a live audience because you can see them. You know, a radio audience is a much different audience, and I had no intentions of ever being a radio host. So, you know, I've learned many things while I've done this. It's now in its third year of this particular program.
But, gee, if I may ask you, I don't, you know, want to be interviewing you that much, but I'd like to know how you developed interest in the paranormal and the UFOs. Was this before your move to New Orleans?
Oh, yeah, that's more or less a lifelong interest, so... Okay. As far as the paranormal thing goes, it dates it was a normal part of our life, you might say. We had lived in a house that was haunted. We moved in that house, well, I guess that must have been about a third grader. Paranormal events were regarded as somewhat normal within our family. You know, my mother talks about the different gifts that people in her family would have, ranging from seeing what she called death masks, which I have a better understanding of them, having seen what is commonly made as a death mask. But what she's referring to the people that see death masks as seeing, I'm not sure. But anytime someone is suffering from ill health or at risk of a serious health problem, yeah, you're serious one, not just, you know, a minor thing. Whoever would see the death mask would see the death mask on the person. So, you know, when you're listening to someone's description of something like that, to try and create an accurate mental picture of what they're seeing, it's kind of tough, for, at least for me.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the movie White Noise Number 2. And if you're familiar with those two movies about the afterlife, in which the fellow could actually see who was the next one to die, you know, by some type of a vision. So I don't know if that's a skill that I'd necessarily want to have, but that's an interesting movie. But I'd love to talk with you about paranormal things or UFOs or medical things, so I'll let you call the shots.
Ah, well, see, we can just wander all over the topic field. Yeah, my mother had always said that, like, we toured a haunted hotel, the last Harvey House that was built, which, if you're familiar with Harvey Houses, they were the... you might say the first hotel chain. They were built along the railroad, and it was to house the first tourists. And the last one was built in Winslow, Arizona. It's called La Posada. And it was built by a woman architect, and I cannot remember her name. Mary Coulter, I think, might be it. Anyhow, it's a very interesting building. It's been restored, and it's operating as a hotel, and they have a restaurant in it. And they have some really peculiar artwork in it. Anyhow, we walked around the public areas touring. It's supposed to be very haunted. And we never, and my mother had told everybody that was in our group, well, if there's a ghost here, she'll find it because she's always been a ghost magnet. And I thought, well, that's a peculiar thing to say, because I didn't really think that, you know, I had that many paranormal events happen in my vicinity. We didn't see anything that day, by the way. It was the most unhaunted place I'd ever been in.
Well, I've come across something called the EVP and radio sweeping and other ways to contact the other side. And in process, I got a hold of a book someone suggested called called People Who Don't Know They're Dead. What an interesting book, because it reminds me of the Sixth Sense movie that I didn't realize had so much background work that went into it. And perhaps, you know, this ability that people can see these death masks and these types of things is... maybe an ability that we all have that we just don't use. So I'd like to hear more about that or talk more about that if you like.
Yeah, you know, that's a gift I personally had, and I know that the people in my family that had that gift, they would be very upset when they would see it on a family member. Usually it would be someone that was in the hospital. They didn't always die. It just meant that they were at risk. They were, you know, near death's door, you might say. They may not go through it, but they were there. And so anytime, you know, and sometimes people would die without it or were having the death mask. So, you know.
Is this an ability you still have?
No, this was not one of my abilities.
Oh, okay.
And this was other family members. So, you know, I'm giving you secondhand information from being around them, and sometimes around them even when they saw it. But, you know, frequently they would get ghost white, the water drain out of their face, and they might shake or whatnot because it would upset them. You know, as far as myself, no. I would say probably the most paranormal thing that I ever had happen is my son died when he was 10 years old unexpectedly. And, you know, as any parent who's lost a child, your grief is intense. And you tend to get kind of weird. You know, there's no other way to put it. You're not rational, especially during those initial few months. And it was probably about 2 months after he died I had a dream, and in this dream, my grandmother was there, and a number of other relatives that had already died, and we were having a family barbecue or picnic, and it was at the back of a big house, and it wasn't a house that was familiar to me, or location even, coming from the desert southwest. This place was, that I was seeing in my dream, was far too green. You would never see that much grass anywhere. And I was fixing a plate of food for my son. And I gave it to him, and I remember looking at him, and he was starting to decay in the stream. And I was rather alarmed. My grandmother was there, and she didn't look like she did in her later years, but she looked like she did when I was a teenager. And she told me, she says, "You've got to quit doing that, or he's going to keep rotting." And I woke up with a start at that point, you know, because that was rather an alarming thing, you know. And at that point, you know, I guess I realized that perhaps the grieving that I was doing was not healthy for me or, you know, in a sense for his spirit either, and that I had to let go.
Was this a recurrent dream to you?
No, that was the first time. It made a profound impression on me. And the person in the dream, my grandmother, she was probably the person of the largest authority in my life. Making my own parents angry at me, you know, that was no big deal. But well, the thought of my grandmother being angry at me would just horrify me.
Let me make a comment about this. That's so interesting. Are you familiar with a technique for grief counseling called EMDR, stands for eye motion desensitization and retraining, eye muscle desensitization and retraining, something that psychotherapists are using to deal with grief of the death of a loved one. And what it is, basically, as you know, during that dream you had, there was a chance that someone had wakened you up from that dream. 82 to 85% of people report during that rapid eye movement phase that they're dreaming. This eye movement desensitization, in a book by Drs. Hogan and Botkin, they describe how it works. And what you do is to have a patient who's going through this grieving process follow your hand, and you start to induce the same kind of rapid eye movements that are seen with dreaming. And what it does, people are able to get through a grief period very fast, maybe in a session or two. And then, by accident, Dr. Botkin noted that he could have these same people then relax, close their eyes, and some of them were suddenly in touch with that person who had died. And I was thinking, as you told this story, Gia, perhaps the way that works, in a way, is to recreate some significant type of dream event, like the dream you just described, and suddenly not only allow you to work with the grief, but to get you through it to the point where you actually have contact with such a person like your son who died. So I thought I'd mention this new technique because for me it's new. I just heard about this within the last few weeks. EMDR, an induced after-death experience, is what it's called.
Huh. That is interesting. I know that for me that particular dream was a turning point in the grieving process. At that point, I became much more emotionally functional. Because I was working, you know, I was doing the normal things, you know, I acted like a human being. But as far as being emotionally functional, no, I really wasn't. I wasn't of any help to my daughter in her grieving process, you know, or anything. You know, it was just, all right, you know, emotionally, it was just, I was doing what I could do. That was it.
Well, it must be the toughest thing in the world, the death of a child, the death of a family member, a close friend, or really to be around anyone dying. And, you know, so this is something for you and the listeners to think about, this EMDR technique that trained psychotherapists are using to get people quickly through that grieving and sometimes in touch with the departed. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, that is an important process. A lot of times we focus so much on the living part that we forget about the dying part. I often have told people that I learned more from my son in 10 years about living, loving, and dying than I ever taught him.
Yes. So his function then must have been to teach you.
Yeah, you do have to let go, you know. You can't emotionally isolate yourself and just pretend that you stopped at that point. You have to just, you know, you might say, walk through the grief and come out on the other side. You know, do I still grieve for him? Yes. Do I still miss him? Yes.
Well,
but
you know, it's tough to get to that point, but you're right.
Anymore.
That's the way we have to look at it, just like you're saying. And it's not easy, but it has to be done.
Yeah, and you know, people often, because I never knew what to say to someone who was grieving. And for anybody who's listening that just had a friend, a family member lose someone close to them, don't go and tell them they're in a better place now. They don't want to hear it. It won't be nice. Because that's not something that is very helpful to very many people during that intense grieving period.
Yes,
you know, you don't want to hear it, and you're not open to it, and it's apt to create a very negative response.
Since you've been through this, what would you say then, from your experiences, is the best way that someone who wants to be helpful and wants to say the right thing, what is the right kind of thing for someone to do to come to someone's assistance at this time?
You know, about all you can say is I'm sorry, really. Just be there for them as friends or family members. Just the words don't matter, if that makes sense. I'm sorry is about as much as there is to be said, because that's what it really is. You're sorry. You're sorry for their pain. You're sorry for their loss.
Yes. I think that's the way the funeral home directors will put it. I'm sorry for your loss, and maybe that summarizes it in the best possible way.
You know, because grief is such a very individual process, you know, and people wander through it, you know, when they're trying to help a friend or a co-worker or whatever, you know, someone they know. They blunder through it because we don't have much practice at it.
Well, I wanted to discuss with you that thing also. I mentioned that the webmaster for my site to promote this book died in February of this year, and it was very sudden. He was 48 years old, and within 2 months, what started as a small pain developed into the diagnosis of terminal cancer.
Uh-huh.
And I flew to London to be with him during that last days of his life. And, you know, the whole process of dying is just amazing. I had been with my mother the year before when she passed, but she was almost 99. She had had a great life, and she was able to sleep her way out of this one. For the last 3 weeks, she was asleep completely. And I had to leave her side to get a little rest, and during that time, she took her last breath, and she did appear to me in a dream, at least, so I had some contact with her. But
uh-huh.
With my friend Martin, now, it was a different story. He and his wife and I were with him at the bedside for that last 12 hours straight without leaving, and we got to see the whole process of shutting down the body. It's truly amazing. And, you know, I felt honored to have been invited to be part of that, and it's not the nicest thing to see a good friend leave, but, you know, when it's time to go, you have to go, and there's not a lot that can be done. But the point I wanted to make, as far as paranormal things go, I have been in touch with him since he died, and the way that came about may be a story that would interest you and your listeners. What do you think?
Yeah, go ahead. I'd love to hear.
Okay, well, what happened was this. You know, Martin and I met because of our mutual interest in remote viewing. And we met on the Courtney Brown chat site. Courtney Brown in Atlanta had started a school to teach people how to remote view. And I think most of the listeners will realize the remote viewing started off with the U.S. Army Stanford Research Institute trying to keep up with the Russian psychics. So they developed a way by testing the famous psychic Ingo Swann to say, well, how can we develop and teach this ability to send our mind out to that collective unconsciousness and download the information about a target? Well, Martin was quite interested in that, as I was a dozen years ago, and that's how we met, and we stayed friends, and we both trained remote viewing with the same person, Major Ed Dave. At any rate, when it came time to set up a website for this book, Martin volunteered to do it. His job was as a computer programmer, and he knew his stuff. So we worked together on that, and then we had it ready near the end of the year, but on November 25th, something very strange happened. I received an email from a Rob Smith in Australia, and he invited me to the Australasian Forum on ITC, which I didn't know at the time, but it's Instrumental Transcommunication. That and EVP, electronic voice phenomena, are ways to contact the departed. Well, yeah, I never thought I'd be interested in this. I had seen that movie Frequency. Remember that movie?
Well, I have to confess, I don't watch movies or TV, so I'm kind of clueless
on
those topics.
Right, but it was a movie in the year 2000 about radio contact with the dead, and at the time I wasn't that interested. But this EVP was kind of an interesting thing, how to turn on a recorder. In the old days it was a tape recorder, to ask questions to the departed and to go back later and analyze that tape and find out what came through. And by having some type of a white noise, some type of a background static that they teach, the entities use to modulate their voices so we can hear them. Nowadays, they're integrated circuit recorders, digital recorders. But at any rate, the point is, I said, Martin, look at this. Would you like to do some research with me? Because I really want to do a project on the afterlife, and this is one way we can try to experiment. He said, yeah, absolutely, I like that stuff. And within a week or two, he developed a very strange pain in his abdomen. And as we talked and as time passed, it got more and more intense and pretty soon led to the diagnosis of colon cancer with a spread to his liver. Well, in London, the day before he died, I brought up the fact of that research project. And I said, Martin, are you still interested in continuing with this project? And he said, absolutely. And the next day he passed. Coming back to Hawaii, at that forum, I came across this technique called radio sweeping. Now, it was new to me, Gia, and it may be new to you and the listeners, but what it is, the way you can sit down with the radio and sweep through that static very quickly to generate that white noise. And on the website, I have a link there that shows how to modify a Radio Shack radio. Steve Holte showed me how to do this on his website, and by cutting one wire, you can make that thing do the sweeping automatically, so you don't have to do anything but sit there. And as soon as I put the thing together, I picked up a digital recorder that I had, and I said, let me give it a try. And out to the ether, I said, Martin, are you there? And I tell you, within 2 seconds, his voice came through clear as a bell with a hello in his British accent and his same intonation. It was eerie. And I've asked the people who have done this for years why I would suddenly have this instant success. And they said, well, doctor, think about it. It's a rare case that you have an opportunity to set this up in advance of someone's passing. So any of your listeners are interested, at the website, if they do a search feature on the website for the word ghost, they'll come to a link that says the enigmatic case of Martin Simmons. And they'll read all about it, starting with a caution. Because, you know, as you mentioned, these better places, there's some bad places, too, and some of these things that come through may not always be kind and pleasant. So you have to approach this with an open and a sane mind. But it's a very interesting thing that happened. So that was my foray into the afterlife, the beginning. And I think now I'm going to do more research, but maybe through dreams rather than through electronic means.
Well, dreams are an interesting state, I think. You know, dream walking is something that my family had talked about and was regarded as normal, and that was where you could interact with other dreamers. You could go places. and this was an old thing before, you know, the New Age stuff all came about with astral travel and whatnot. But it sounded, is astral travel and what they call dream walking sound like very similar things, in a sense. And, you know, to interact with people that had passed on in your dream state was almost normal.
It was. And think about the Aborigines, Australia Aborigines and their dream time. And even in Hawaii, there's a lot about dreams. And in cultures of the time of ancient Egypt and perhaps before that, dreaming was a big thing. And I think it should be a big thing. At least Robert Moss, author of several books on conscious dreaming, has taught me a lot about this now in reading his books and talking and speaking with him. And it's something I think we can incorporate into the healing process for our own benefit or for others. And it's something that really bears some discussion and some thought. I think it's a fascinating field.
Well, I've seen it often, okay? A number of cases where Native Americans refer to it as soul sickness. And that's what they call, like, alcoholism, drug addiction. It's a sickness of the soul.
Yes.
And you can't cure the addiction unless you can fix what's the matter with the soul. Or the spirit, whatever
exactly
you want
right. And you and Robert Moss are on the same page with that because it has to do... In fact, you know, I like to quote one of the things he said about healing and using dreams for healing. He feels, as I do, and I've always felt, there is a, like a master physician. That's the one inside that knows what's going on with us. And Mr. Moss says the way to contact that healer is to start with a statement of wholesome intention. And it's got to be requested in the right way. And he suggests to try this. This affirmation, I ask for the measure of health my body requires to serve the purposes of the soul. And that's very well put, and just as you said, there is a healer waiting to help, but it's got to be approached in the right way. But I think we all have this ability, and not only for ourselves, but for others. So you said that exactly right. There was a case in my book that he brought up this morning in an interview, and it was a case of a young Hawaiian boy who was injured severely and was brain dead, and I couldn't really save his life, but the family couldn't decide to take him off the respirator or not. And as I told the story to Mr. Moss, he asked me to please recount this story for his listeners, I told about when I had a dream, and in the dream, I was making rounds in the ICU, and suddenly the boy started breathing. As the nurse and I watched him, a tear came from his eye. And then he started breathing, and then he stopped. And when I went to the hospital that morning, I called right away, and they said, no, there's no change, doctor. He's still respirator-dependent. But that morning, when I made it to the hospital to see him, as the nurse and I stood there watching, not only did a tear come from his eye, he took a breath. And it was astounding. I couldn't believe that someone in a brain-dead state, meaning no electrical activity of the brain, could ever recover to start breathing again. Well, he didn't. It didn't last long, and eventually, telling the family about the dream and about his condition, they agreed to remove him from the respirator. But the key thing is, the father came later to explain to me that dream meant that he wanted to be let go. It wasn't so much that he was going to survive. It's the fact that he contacted me in that dream state was to make me aware of his condition and perhaps talk to the family again so he could go. Well, that was all great. And what I learned today was that in the Hawaiian belief, and I should have known this, I've been here 28 years, but Robert Moss knew this, that the tear duct is called the soul pit, and it's believed that the soul can exit the body through the tear duct of the eye. And, you know, I had to think about that. You're going to be interviewing John Lerma coming up, I see, right?
Yes.
And I wrote to him today to ask him, had he heard of this? It was new to me, and every time I saw a patient in a coma or when dying, I thought that tear was a reflex mechanism of the automatic nervous system. That's what we're taught, and that it's not a tear of sadness or anything else. But now with this thought of, is this the way the ancients have said the soul leaves the body? That could explain a lot of these tears we see right at the time of death.
Well, chemical came in hand with the whole thing. The eyes are the window of the soul. And a lot of people assume that because Native Americans don't like to meet you eye to eye, that, you know, you're hiding something. And in reality, it's because to stare someone in the eye is challenging, you're disrespectful, you are, you know, if you're psychic, you're trying to look where you're window peeping. Put it bluntly, you're window peeping, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just not done. Yeah. And, you know, so they have the tear duct, the exit for the soul. You know, windows open, you know.
Well, you know, it was news to me today, and it got me to really thinking throughout the day as, gee, maybe I was missing something all this time. I chalked it up to a reflex response of the body. It could be a very deep thing to be aware of. So I think by the chance you have, by the time you speak to John Lerman, maybe something you may want to bring up and see what his thoughts are on the matter.
Uh-huh, because that is interesting. And, you know, dreams, you know, we've all heard the saying, let me sleep on it, okay? And when I say it, I mean it quite literally, because in my sleep, I will work through the problem. I can try out many, many scenarios until I find a solution. Now, I may not be well-rested the next morning, but I have the solution.
Well, you know,
in our dreams, we do many, many things.
Yes, and critical things, big things like the periodic table of elements came to a dream, the hexagonal ring and organic chemistry came to the dream. So there's so many things that if we put our mind to work on it while we're sleeping, it can come to us in a dream or during that sleep period. And it's something I think that we all can become very interested in because we spend a lot of our life asleep and a lot of that time dreaming. So it's good to make use of those dreams in the best possible manner. So I'm really interested in dreaming now.
Well, you know, I know that I grew up being told, like, to wake yourself up. My mother would say it. Program yourself to do it when you're going to bed, and you'll wake up. I'm one of those people that have had insomnia since childhood. So there were times when I wouldn't be falling asleep till an hour or so before I was supposed to get up. And therefore, there were some mornings where the alarm didn't wake me up as quickly as it should have.
We had the same mother. Because I remember my mother, she was a psychologist, but when I was a child, I remember her saying, here's how I do it, Jack. She said, I want to wake up at 6. I hit my pillow and I say, I want to wake up at 6. And she did. And, you know, now that I look back and you mentioned that about your mother, I realize, wow, maybe all mothers know how to do that.
My mother, she was big on, she says, we program ourselves and we program our children. And, you know, you don't tell your children negative things about them because you're programming them for failure. Would I say I had perfect children? No, but I did try to be conscious, at least not to program them too much negatively.
And, you know, it's interesting about children and even newborns. When we talk about dreaming and children and these rapid eye movements when people are waking up, you ask them what was going on and they report dreams. You know, I've always wondered, now, what goes on with the newborn in the newborn nursery when we see these same eye movements? And also now in utero on these machines can tell the same thing is going on. And what could those if they represent dreams? Are they from a past life? I don't know. What do you think, Gia?
You know, I've had... here's a case in point, okay? While I was pregnant with my daughter, who's now 26, I crocheted a lot. I also listened to Renaissance music. That was my kick then, okay? So I listened to Renaissance music and I crocheted a gazillion things, all sorts of things. So I'm always playing with strings, and I'm listening to strings in my ears, the harpsichord, the violin, all the instruments from the Renaissance. When she was born, I can remember one of the satin bindings on a blanket had started to fray, and she was just a couple months old at the most. She couldn't even sit up on her own yet. She was holding the blanket up with one hand, and the other hand, those very, very fine satin threads, she was playing with them with her fingers. And it was as though she was fascinated by the strings. And it was, I'm watching her do that because she was holding up so the light caught them. And I thought, you know, all those things about watch what you do, say, think while you're pregnant because it marks the baby may have more... I mean, often the folk tales have generated to birthmarks. But maybe the things that we do, say, watch, and so forth and so on while we're pregnant does influence the baby's character.
Well, you know, it's well known what cigarette smoking will do, alcohol use and all these other things, not enough folic acid and all that. But I remember my sister, who you remind me of a lot, told me a long time ago, she said, Jack, remember this, thoughts are objects. And what you're thinking is going to come to pass. And maybe those thoughts are something that a mother can transmit to that newborn, and you know, about to be born, I mean. So it's something we've got to be cognizant of and be aware of from the time the baby's developing and all through life. It's a critical thing.
Well, I know that, I was thinking over it over the last year, and last year a friend of mine's daughter was having a baby, and she'd taken to watching a lot of really violent horror movies while she was pregnant. And I remember telling her, you know, that might not be the best idea you've had.
That
might not be the sorts of things. And then, you know, as you start looking at the increase in violence in schools and whatnot, is, you know, the root cause going clear back to the movies the mother watched? I mean, you know, is that...
Well, I can tell you this much. You know, there's certain hormonal things that come out in the bloodstream when you're watching exciting things, or even maybe when you're seeing the color red as opposed to the color blue, and eventually these hormones can perhaps affect the fetus. I mean, I think about the people I know who are vegetarians, and when I first asked them why, this one fellow told me, he said, look, let me tell you, I live near a slaughterhouse, and on the night of the week before the cows are going to be slaughtered, they just wailed like they knew what was coming. And he said, think about how they kill them, you know, they string them up, they knock them in the head with a device to knock them unconscious, they slit their throats and they let them bleed. I'm sorry to be so graphic about this, but anyway, it's felt that it releases all those hormonal things of fright and fear into the bloodstream that contaminates the meat in a way that he didn't want to have as part of his body, and it makes perfect sense, perfect sense. So I can see the same thing coming about if a pregnant woman is watching some violence or exposed to violence or isn't being treated right by her man. It's a terrible thing for the child, and we've got to be aware of that because it can be quite detrimental.
Yeah, that reminds me. When I was pregnant with my daughter, I could not eat meat. It made me so sick. I couldn't look at it, couldn't smell it, couldn't eat it, and it had nothing to do with meat. And today she's mostly a vegetarian. She does eat some meat, but she's mostly a vegetarian.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I couldn't say I understand the connection, but it's kind of plausible that perhaps...
It was kind of strange because I did. I became very, very ill. I couldn't stand the smell of it. I couldn't stand the look at it. Yeah, and that was through the entire pregnancy. No meat.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at this meat, and I'm wondering, should we be really raising and killing these animals if there's another way to get protein? I mean, after all, so I've been fairly successful in cutting out all that type of meat, and you know, I have to think about the fish. Now, that may be another matter. When I've tried to fish, I think they have a fair chance because they're always able to get away from my hook. I don't have very good luck. But it seems a more fair thing to do. And as long as they're not full of mercury and stuff, maybe that's the only kind of meat we really need to even consider eating. But maybe not even that. You know, maybe the purest way is with vegetables and fruits grown without pesticides and fertilizers and try to be as healthy as possible.
You know, I often wonder, you know, that all the things that are fed to animals in a commercial meat operation, you might say, you know, whether that's really all that good for us. Up until relatively recently in my life, most of my life, I had not eaten commercial raised meat. I hadn't thought about it much until fairly recently. I didn't even realize, though, until just the last few months, that unconsciously, and I'm not Catholic, on Fridays I eat fish. And it's pretty consistent that I will do that, even if I'm not really all that aware of what day of the week it is. And my response when it was pointed out to me is, the only thing I can say is, a former life, I must have been Catholic, because I have no idea.
Yeah, but I think it's good for you that you can do that. And if you could eat 4 or 5 fish meals a week and follow the Mediterranean diet, you know, with nuts and other things like that, you know, you'd stay healthy. That's a good idea. I should think
about it. Well, in New Orleans, seafood is wonderful. You know, it's everywhere, you know. shrimp, oysters, crawfish, fish of every kind. It's everywhere. And fish is a very, fish and shellfish are a very common meal.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's talk about this, if you don't mind. This eating diet, the way we think, the way we treat our newborns and our children after they're born, the way we treat each other. Well, what do you think about this? Do you believe, first of all, what's your feeling? Do you believe that we have this one life and then after that it's kind of lights out? Or from what you've said so far, it seems like you know there are other dimensions and things going on, and probably the people who have passed on, they may be more interested in trying to contact us than we are in trying to contact them. They may have a lot to ask, a lot to say, and there may be all these myriad of dimensions where these things are existing. What is your thought about it, and what could we talk about in that regard?
I would say in general, because my thoughts on it are continually evolving, but I don't think it's lights out when we die, obviously.
Yeah.
There were some instances after my son died that said he was hanging around, for a while, lights being switched on and off, television being switched on and off, as though he was saying, hey, I'm here. and that went on for a few weeks. My family does things a little bit peculiar. After the funeral and the cremation, it may be a couple of weeks or whatever before the ashes are buried. We no longer bury a body, we just bury ashes. And so it's a very private ceremony that we have, when we can get together. It's usually a couple of weeks after the funeral. And between the funeral and the burial, we had a lot of very strange electrical activity going on, you might say. And so, I would say definitely we continue on. I think we're probably reincarnation is, if we don't learn it on this round, we get to come back and do it again. Until we learn what we need to know.
And the people who we come across who are doing some really dastardly deeds, and there's plenty of those, what do you think happens to them for this next incarnation? Do you think they, as a result, they're going to have even a worse time to make up for all that evilness and harm they've caused? Or do you think at the end, I want to be forgiven and not have any consequence?
I think the worst time is kind of maybe relative. But we're going to leave everybody hanging on the edge of that cliff. It's time for a break. So, folks, stay tuned to the Dawn of Shades, and we will be right back with our guest, Dr. John Turner. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, G.S. Scott, and once again, I'd like to remind everyone to visit the website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, let me know what you think of it. There are links there to take you to our blogs, Twitter, Facebook, whatever. With that, we're going to get right back to our conversation with our guest, Dr. John L. Turner, author of Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestation. And just before the break, we left everyone hanging on the cliff as to what happens after death and what, really I thought about it. And, we continue talking on the break. You all missed that part. But I have to believe that we definitely continue after death, and I am leaning very, very strongly to the reincarnation thing. And this is not the first time I've been living a life on this planet. So obviously, I'm not perfect, okay? Yeah. How about you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Talking to me or the listeners, I was just listening to you and kind of transfixed by what you were saying. Oh, no. I'm a long way from being perfect, but I think if you were to look at that cover they picked for the book, it has a dandelion in what's known as the clock phase, ready to spread those things out to the wind.
Uh-huh.
As you know, each one's going to grow a new flower like that, and most people consider them weeds, but it kind of symbolizes, in a way, for a lot of people, good luck. In another way, this idea of reincarnation, and that, like you said exactly, we're here to learn these lessons, and if we don't learn it, we're going to keep doing it until we get it right. I mean, my wife told me that. I have to clarify, it was my second wife. I hate to say I was a very slow learner in those days.
Uh-huh.
But back when I was a resident neurosurgery, when she just stopped me one day and said, Jack, let me tell you something. Life is a series of learning experiences. As soon as you've learned one lesson, as soon as you've really learned it, the next one is waiting for you right around the corner. And instead of trying to understand what she was saying, I looked at her like she didn't know what she was talking about. I was just too wrapped up in my own ego-centric things or whatever you call them. So, but now I have to give her all the credit for saying, hey, this is what it's about. We come here to learn. This is a good place to learn. And in fact, the closer you come to learning that, the more you see how cause and effect works and that whatever you put out there is going to come around. And if it's good, that's good. And if it's bad, it's going to come and bite you just like you put it out. Kind of a different law of the universe that just seems to operate all the time.
Now, do you think, okay, like the bad things that happen to us, do you think that it's because we've earned it?
Well, I think probably a better way to look at it is the things that happen to us and not try to judge good or bad, because they're all experiences that we were meant to go through. Now, you know, I discuss different types of healing. One is the emitting a spiritual light from the hand, and it's called Jurei, the medical art of Japan that was developed by one man named Okichi Okada. And basically, in his process of learning these lessons we're talking about, he became enlightened. And actually, he was truly enlightened. He received a sphere of light energy that lodged in his body. And he said, I can feel this. It's a 4-centimeter globe of energy. And now, whatever he touched, the people were being healed. But the point I want to get at with him is that he became prolific as an artist and as a poet. And as an author, and one poem he wrote was called The Way a Man Should Live. And it ended with this stanza. It said, let us have the strength to bear with any hardship, any mistreatment, accepting it with a smile just as though it were nothing. Now, it sounds easy when it's read, but when I came across that, I said, now, how do I get to the point where whatever happens, you know, rather than call it good or bad or whatever, accept it with a smile? And the just as though it were nothing I come to learn means because it was supposed to happen. It was already planned to happen, and I've added a little caveat to that, that I was involved in that planning, so when things happen, how can I get upset or angry? I've got to instead try to say, now, wait a minute, what's the lesson here? What am I to learn from this and to extract that? And as my wife said, prepare for the next one because it's waiting. They're all lined up waiting for you. So that's my thought. So when something that others might look at the situation and say, oh, that's terrible, I'm so sorry, or that's really bad, you've got to realize for me, and perhaps them too, this is the learning involved. And it may not be bad at all. And it's like the old story about the man who, you know, had a horse that ran away, and then it came back, and then the son broke a leg and all that, and people always said, well, we're so sorry, these things are happening to you. And then when the army came and bypassed his son because of the broken leg, you know, and they said, hey, well, what could he say? You know, is it good or is it bad? It's just the way it is. And I think Zen Buddhism is the best way that looks at the whole process of this life and this universe and sums it up in one word, and that one word is thus. Things are the way they are because this is the way it is. And we just need to, my feeling is, we need to try to live in the moment, Gia, and try to be aware of everything, good, bad, plus or minus, and realize this is a learning lesson.
Yeah, that's very true. And often, apparently this is the message I'm needing to learn right now, is live in the moment, because I've heard that so often here lately. People will tell me, you know, you need to live in the moment. You need to just let it go, live in the moment. And, you know, maybe that is something that all of us need to pay attention to.
Well, Gia, I was lucky. I had a teacher who was my mother. She came to live with us the last 5 years of her life here in Hawaii. And she suffered from Alzheimer's disease. And I watched the progression of that. And it's a terrible disease that at age 62, 15% of people will get it. At age 85, 50% will get it. And unless a cure is found, we're all going to end up with this at some point if we live long enough. But it really destroys the short-term memory. And during the last year, she was completely bedridden during that year, but I got to see her memory get down to as short as 10 to 15 seconds that she could focus on something. And then she'd have to start all over again. Everything would be almost brand new and forgotten to her. But during that 10 to 15 seconds, from period to period, she was living in the moment, literally. It was a fascinating process to watch. As I said, she was almost 99 when she died a year ago. But, I got to thinking about why she had such a long life and wasn't painful life. And, you know, it had to end this way with her memory going. She was aware of that at first, and then she got to the point where she was beyond that, just struggling to live from moment to moment. And if we can get to that point before we're ill with some disease like that and say, look, let me be fully aware of everything, let all my senses and faculties be fully aware, that's the point to reach. And there's scientific evidence to say that if we can be at that point, yeah, we might be able to have a small element of free will. And I say that because scientifically it appears that we lag behind what's going on by a third of a second. The work of Dr. Benjamin LeBay and others have shown this to be the case. And there's an electrical potential, Gia, that can be picked up from the scalp by EEG recording, but also can be shown now on functional MRI scans. It's potential, called in German the Breitschaft potential. That's all one word, Breitschaft potential. And books are devoted to this. And basically what it is the recording showing that these parts of the brain are firing off to cause a motor action a third of a second before we're aware that we're going to do that very action. So in order to be in the moment, we can take advantage of what Dr. LeBay found was a fifth of a second period in which we might be able to to affect that which is already in progress. I hope that makes a little sense to you. I had to zip through that kind of fast, but that's what I'm thinking. If we're sharp and our minds are not adulterated with drugs or bad thoughts or anything, we're sharp, we can live in the moment and maybe take advantage of making a slight correction to our ship when we need to.
Well, you know, when you talk about it, I remember years ago I had a car accident. It was a nasty one, and I went through the windshield and hit my head hard enough that I was left blind for, like, 8-12 hours, something like that, just from the recoil. And one of the side effects of, you know, bashing yourself that hard is I was left with temporarily no short-term memory. And so if I ate something and stood up from the table and turned around, when I turned back around, I didn't know who'd eaten, what they'd eaten, or when they'd eaten it. I had no idea. I had no 2 minutes ago. It was gone. It was gone.
I know what you're talking about because, I observed that, and it's something. You know, it's a rough thing. There's no question about it. You were fortunate. You recovered.
I was only missing short-term memory. I had mid-term and long-term.
But the short-term memory came back.
It took about, 4 they explained to me exactly what was going on was probably 5 months, and it, once I knew what was going on, then because stress increased the severity.
Well, let me tell you something that will be interesting for your listeners. It was for me, and I'm learning as I go, too. And for years, it had always been taught that we are born with a certain number of brain cells that will develop, and then when that stops, that's it. That's our complement. I always heard figures thrown about when I was going to school that we leave 70 neurons a second and alcohol potentiate that loss and all that stuff. Well, new research shows that we do manufacture new nerve cells in the brain.
Uh-huh.
They are formed in the area called the hippocampus, which is that area that's responsible for short-term memory in a way, right, in the temporal lobes of the brain. And they last a few weeks, but they'll go away. They'll die out unless they're put to use. So we have to use our brains. That adage, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it, is very correct when it comes to the brain and memory. But I remember in medical school being shown a video of a doctor who was in the hospital to evaluate her loss of memory, and she had a permanent loss of short-term memory due to a stroke.
Uh-huh.
She couldn't leave the room of her hospital to go out into the hall. She would find herself completely lost and completely new surroundings to her again, and she couldn't find her way back. And this was going to be a lifelong thing for this relatively young doctor. So you were lucky. My mother was lucky in a way that she developed this in the last part of her life, last stages of her life, and it made her passing a lot easier because she she didn't concentrate on anything at all, but tried to live a little longer. So that must have been a frightening experience for you.
See, I spent my time hiding the fact that I had a problem. I worked as a police dispatcher at the time. I have no short-term memory. And imagine this. I am a police dispatcher. I have no short-term memory. No one except my four-year-old daughter was aware of the fact that I had no memory.
So you wrote everything down right away.
I carried around steno notebooks all the time. Up until I moved to New Orleans, I still would occasionally run across one that had everything that I said, did, the time, everything, right there.
Well, something chilling for you, and I know you don't like movies, but there's a movie called Memento, which describes a young man going through exactly that. And what he has to do is to tattoo his body in order to make these notes so he doesn't lose them.
Yeah, I couldn't. I had a bag. And I could not have the bag and the notebook out of sight because, see, if it got out of sight, I didn't know where it was. It was gone. Forever.
How long, Gia?
I had the accident in early September. I didn't go see the neurologist until early February. I had gone back to college, and for the first time in my life, no matter how much I studied, I flunked everything. It was like I would take a test and I had no idea what this material was about. I had no idea. It was like I had never read any of this stuff. I decided, and people will laugh, okay, but I decided that I must be crazy. And so, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm in my, I think it was 25. I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, okay, I'm crazy. Now, what are you supposed to do when you're crazy? And then I think, well, I think I read someplace that a crazy person should go see their doctor first. Okay. So I called my doctor and made an appointment. I go in and I tell him, I think I'm crazy. I'm flunking out of college. I can't, you know, I'm not functioning right. And he just kind of looked at me and he referred me to a neurologist. And I will never forget this. When I walked into the neurologist's office, he's got my file from the hospital. He's got the stuff from my doctor. And he asked me some questions, and I told him, I think I'm crazy. He laughed at me.
But he could easily find out by checking you out that it was...
They had just gotten the very first MRI machine, which tells you how long ago it was, in Arizona. There was one in Mesa, Arizona. It took up an entire building. And they sent me there for an MRI. And it was a big deal, and I got my first full-blown migraine on top of the post-trauma migraine. Because I'm claustrophobic. Okay? Nobody knew any of this stuff ahead of time, you know, that in 45 minutes, it's a long time. And, but anyhow, they told me exactly what happened during the impact, what had caused each of the things that had happened to me. One of the things that really inspired me to think I was crazy was my emotions misbehaved. Instead of having a body seizure, like my emotions would have a seizure. And I would start laughing hysterically or crying or cursing, and I had never been one for cursing. For no reason. You know, I knew there was no reason, and yet I'm doing it, and I couldn't stop it. And I didn't want to go out in public. I didn't want to go to any public events because I never knew when it was going to happen. And, you know, explaining to me, A, you need to quit college, you can't do it right now, and B, this is going to go away, and stress does make it worse. You know, it gave me control over it, knowing what was wrong with me, and, you know, what kind of time frames I could look at to get past it. And you figured in about 12 months, the worst of the effects would be gone. And, you know, he said, just don't make any major life changes right now because you can't use your emotions to gauge it. And, you know, you've got a lot of healing to go on.
You know,
and it did. It worked for me.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, it's strange that you would mention that because you mentioned my website. If you go there and you use that search feature and you type in The Edge of Madness, you'll see a couple of chapters of a fiction book that I'm writing that has to do with this kind of a memory loss. Turns out there's a entity called transient global amnesia, And I've seen a couple of cases of this in which the person forgets all their short-term memory is just gone, but it only lasts one day. And this is a story about a man who woke up in the back alley in Honolulu with no memory at all of who he was and how he got there. The difference is, it turned out with his investigations that he found out he was very rich and wealthy, and it's a mystery story. But having seen that happen and going through my mother's illness triggered this off to make me study memory and to research it a little bit. So what you went through must have been a real living hell to not be able to have that short-term memory. It's so critical.
You know, I think it made me very paranoid about memory. I get very upset when I forget things to this day. And it's been 30 years, you know, a long time. You know, since then. And, you know, to this day, I will, if I forget something, it really upsets me. If I can't remember where I put something, if I forget to pay a bill, if I forget something I wanted to do, you know, an event or something, it upsets me more than it should, because I'm afraid that I'm going to get back to where I can't remember anything.
I'm very sorry to hear that. What did the MRI show? You mentioned that. What did they
diagnose? They said that the impact was to the forehead. They said it bruised the emotions, short-term and short-term memory, and the recoil had gotten the vision.
Yeah, temporal lobe contusion, because, you know, the area we're talking about is in what's called the temporal lobe, the temple being, you know, right above in front of the ear, that area of the brain. And hopefully you had it only on one side, not both sides, but you don't remember anything.
Actually, it was dead center of my forehead.
Wow. That's where you got hit, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And that's where they told me that the bruising and whatnot had occurred. And then when the brain recoiled in the skull, that's what left me blind and then with the vision disturbance for a while after that.
Well, you know, you went through an ordeal that very few people have to go through, but unfortunately you pulled through it.
Well, you know, it makes me realize, A, how wonderful vision is. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. You know, and it is. It's a wonderful thing, being able to see and being able to remember. I have known people who were not as fortunate as me, that they didn't regain their vision and that they didn't regain their memory. And I'm lucky. Oh, am I lucky.
I would say you are. And I think we're all lucky to have those of us who have good health. And the ones who don't, I think we can improve that health if we just start working on that mind-body connection and trying to work on it ourselves as well as with the doctor.
You know, sometimes it makes you wonder why you can have two people with very similar injuries, very similar severity, and yet one recovers and one doesn't do well, doesn't recover at all, it's even possibly even fatal. You know, what's really the difference?
Well, it could be in the friends and doctors and nurses. Now, if you talk about two individuals in the same injury, in the same hospital, with the same staff, and with close family, it's the same, well, then maybe it has to do with the immune system, how strong that is, and then maybe again, sometimes maybe it's a matter of luck, but I think it's more of what's been written for this person to go through and what the lessons are. And maybe these lessons are not just for that person, but for everyone involved, from the doctors to the family members. So I don't know if I would ever have an answer to that, except that...
Well, you know, often you will see that. You know, you're left with a question of why did this person... You know, as a doctor, I'm sure you've dealt with that. Why did this person die? They should not have died.
Well, I used to think that it was a matter of the draw, and when your number is called, that's it. And I still believe that much of it, but I don't think it's a matter of luck anymore, as I may have said. I think it's a matter of what is in the interest of that person and everyone connected with that person. What's in the best, highest good for all involved? I think somehow it works through that kind of a principle. And, you know, it's rough to say. I mean, I started that book out with a case of an intraoperative prayer that I thought saved the lady's life. But at the time, I said part of that prayer was for her to come out of this in the best possible way. Without knowing, that best possible way for her and all that operating table. That may have been what the best possible plan was. But at the time, I thought the best thing was for her to live, and luckily that's what happened. But I think that's what happens here. The best possible thing that happens, according to what's already written to happen, and it's going to happen with very few exceptions, which there are some, but it's going to go right according to plan, and we're going to be players in this play that unfolds, and we're going to be like, what the Shakespeare said, we strut and fret our hours on the stage, and then like a candle, a brief candle, we're heard no more. That's probably the way it goes.
Yeah, and that could very well be. You know, going back to losing my son, you know, even then when I was grieving so intensely, I said, you know, it's funny. It's like I knew all along I was going to lose him. And I, at the time, and I can't say I disagree with what I said then. I said, I feel as though I was given a choice. It could either happen unexpectedly or I could know ahead of time. And I chose not to know. And, you know, it was like he was my borrowed child that I, at some level, knew that I wasn't going to get to keep him, as the saying goes. And, that you know, he was, because it, with him, basically, the autopsy didn't give us any answers as to why he died. And so you were left with, you know, why did a perfectly healthy child, because in my particular case, he died, and the day before, I just got my sister out of intensive care. She was the sick one, he was the healthy one.
Well, you certainly have been through a lot to you. My gosh, my hat's off to you for making it through all this and with a good understanding of how it probably works. I think you're right. It's, these things were supposed to be. And I
does it make it any easier to swallow? Not really.
No, it doesn't. But you know, I talk about what happened after I thought there was some type of a higher power, a god or something, when that lady's life was saved. The next case, very next case, was the death of a child that, to me, was kind of inexplicable and unexpected. And it was just something. And then I went to the funeral, which they called a celebration of life. And as I heard the mother talk about it, they said just what you said, that at least they can say they were happy to have had this young girl for those 9 or 10 years that they had her. And by donating her organs so that another might live, they felt that's what she would have wanted. And they called this a celebration of life. And it,
yeah, I can understand that. I also donated with my son, although because it was an unattended death, his corneas were the only part that could be used. But, you know, it was because he was such a giving person, he would have wanted it that way.
Yeah, that's exactly the same story. So amazing how we have these same kind of things that happen, you know.
And I think about it, even during the funeral, the eulogy was delivered by the man that had been my son's martial arts instructor for 5-6 years. And he talked about my son one day telling him that he wanted to be a... I forget the name all of a sudden. It's the really fat wrestlers.
Yes, a sumo.
Sumo, yeah. He wanted to be one of those because they got to eat all they wanted.
Yes.
He loved food. He really did love food. And yeah. So, yeah, you know, and I remember laughing, you know, because it was so much his personality.
Yeah.
And it was. It was a celebration of his life, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's strange how many things we've discussed that we've hit on that you've gone through the same type of things I've been interested in discussing, but you've actually gone through those things, so that's really amazing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and I don't perceive myself as a strong person at all. But, you know, I say I subscribe to the one foot in front of the other ideology. You know, you just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and sooner or later you're going to get there. Yeah.
Well, you don't have much choice unless you want to repeat some lessons. So by taking the easy way out, although there are easy ways out of this, you know, Sylvia Brown is one of the psychics that describe these exit points where sometimes you may want to get yourself out of these situations. But still, in my mind, it means you haven't to learn the lessons you were designed to learn.
Well, see, you know, and I can understand that because after my son's death, I felt as though I was given a choice. I could just exit out of the game, you might say, without penalty. I could choose insanity, and I just go on my happy little way, and none of it would matter anymore. I could quit. But that's really not my nature to quit. I have to know the rest of the story.
No, I agree with you completely. Yes, no question about it.
Yeah, but I would say that for a couple of weeks, everything
we've talked about, it's just exactly my conclusions, and you must have learned all these things way before me, because a lot of things I'm learning and still learning.
Well, do I have all the answers? Oh, no. I have many lessons learned. That's just this year. There's many things that I have to learn, and many things that I've had to bang my head on repeatedly before it sunk in. And, I get to do this radio show, and it's really, really cool because I get to talk to people who are like you, been there, done that, going to the same place. And that's an affirmation. That was the right road that I went down,
I know exactly what you're saying. Everyone thinks this way. It's just that they don't take time to sit down and slow down a bit and really practice it. They'd like to, but there's so many things that pull people one way or another, things they have to accomplish and do. They just have obligations. But at some point, they may have time to reflect on these things and to really cogitate on the importance. And I really personally think the key thing is tied up with the word aloha, which in Hawaiian means hello and goodbye. But also, it's tied up very strongly with the feelings and things around love. It has a lot to do with love and that aloha spirit they talk about. So it's one thing that enabled me to reach this kind of understanding was to be in a place like this where, it's a pleasant place to live. You don't have a lot of angry people around. And although it's not perfect, it certainly is nice when you have flowers blooming year-round. The story with that. So that's the thing.
Yeah.
I think we're here to learn love, and that's what we've got to work on.
I think really love is the lesson, and learning to give it, learning to receive it, learning to accept it, and learning to let it go sometimes.
Yes.
And those are all very, very difficult lessons. They sound easy, but they are very, very difficult lessons. Like I said, in 10 years, I learned more about living, loving, and dying from my son than I ever taught anyone else. And, I guess it was all about being in the moment and, I guess to just be in the moment, like completely in the moment, because he always was.
Yeah, amazing that we'd be talking about that, because I don't talk with a lot of people about that, because a lot of people don't really want to talk about that or ask about it or want to hear it, but it's amazing how we've been on the same page with everything. And I wonder, Gia, if you and I, is there something we don't agree on? Because so far, you've hit the nail on the head right with my thinking with everything.
Let's see. Let's find something. Here's a topic. We talked about it briefly on break. Aliens.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
You think about alien entities visiting this planet?
Well, the Jesuit priest, Teilhard de Chardin, said he's the one that we give credit to that expression, we are not human beings on a spiritual journey, but spiritual beings on a human journey. And when you look around at this, and if you think that it appears that all life started in the Rift Valley in Africa, right? And we look around all the various people and how that happened. Was it just spread in migration and it caused all these things? Or did we all come from someplace else? Now, I have a son, my third son, who is 4 years old now. I was at an event, actually, this was a book signing in Hilo, and he came along, and everyone liked him. He's a cute boy. He's half Japanese and half what we call over here poi dog. He's a mixture of, like me, of everything else. He's very intuitive, and his name means one who intends to follow the right path. And he's a beautiful boy, and you can see pictures of him on that website in the last blog entry in particular. He's just a good child. And often, when I look at him, I have to think, gee, what would it be like if something happened to him or I lost him? And, I've got to say the way perhaps to avoid having to face that, I've just got to continue to do my best to, as my mother did, to always be available to help other people no matter what it takes, and I've got to try that, and maybe he'll continue this great life. But during that book signing, I used him as an example, and I said, Doshi, I said, a lot of nice people have come to hear me discuss this, but tell them something. What happens to us? It looks like we're being called away one by one. And he said to these people, because, you know, he learned this from me, of course, but he said, that's right. One by one, we're going home. And I said, well, why are we being called home? And he said, because this is not our home. And he intuitively realizes this. And I've been questioning him since he could first listen and talk to try to tell me, where was he before he came here to live with his mommy and daddy? And at first, he was able to describe some things. And as he gets older and he's around other kids and things, it's slowly getting out of his memory. But like the Bible said, what does it be like little children to enter the kingdom of heaven? You know, when they're like this, they're really close to that because they're kind of pure and nice, right? But I don't think this is our home. And are there aliens among us? I don't know. And are those who investigate that have a propensity to maybe get a little strange? I mean, that's what we were talking about. I don't know about that because I've never really tried to investigate it a lot, but it did pop into a lot of those remote viewing sessions. Suddenly this alien energy just kind of popped up. And I don't know if this is because Ed Dames had this interest in aliens or what, but some of those sessions were really of interest. Now, to say, were we locking onto the right parallel universe, I still wonder about that because they were very strange. So what's your thought, Gia?
Well, you know, talking about out of an alpha babe, I remember when my son was 5, 6 years old and he happened to be an avid Star Wars fan. And we'd watched it for the umpteenth joyous time. And I was walking through the room and he says, Mom, he says, I know all about God now. And I'm like, oh yeah? He says, yeah, it's just like the Force. He says, there's the dark side and there's the Force. I said, that's it. Okay.
Yeah,
and I thought about it and I thought, you know what? I never regarded Star Wars as a great spiritual enlightening movie, but to him it was, and he made a very valid point.
Well, he did, and of course a lot of thought went into that a movie like that and these good movies that to kind of teach us something. In that case, it was about the Force. Then I wonder, what is a movie like The Matrix teaching us? Now, of course, you don't like movies. I don't know if you saw The Matrix.
I saw The Matrix, at least part of it. I may not have sat through the entire thing. So I do have an idea what that one was about. And, you know, I don't know. I guess often I look at television. I own a television. It was plugged in a year and a half or so ago last. And now I guess without a converter box, I can't even get a program on it, so I'm not really worried about it. But I do own it so that when people come to visit, I can turn on the TV. And, you know, my daughter came to visit, and she said, where's your TV? And I said, it's on the floor behind the futon. That's where it was at the time. But programming, you know, I really look at TV and I go, there's a lot of programming going on there with 100 and some channels. You know, is that really good for people? Now, I know there's some things on TV that are very interesting.
Yeah.
But is it programming us to be passive as we watch these horrible things?
You know, I agree completely with the TV. However, I have to tell you, I disagree with you a little bit about movies because there's some great movies that are done to teach us. It's like some great books are written to teach. And these movies, you know, I usually analyze them carefully. I go through the director's cut, you know, and I come across a good movie. And two such good movies I want to mention because your listeners may have an interest. One is called The Journey. Not only a beautiful movie, there's some very deep points. And even after 3 or 4 viewings, I haven't gotten the whole message of that movie. But I would recommend The Fountain is the movie. I'm sorry, not The Journey. The Fountain. All right?
Uh-huh.
The second movie is Waking Life. Now, you know, when the movie What the Bleep came out, you remember that perhaps, I asked my oldest son about that. I had heard about it, and he said, Dad, don't waste your time with that. He said, you know, that's only the stuff you and I talk about all the time. He said, if you really want to open your mind a little bit, he said, you should see Waking Life. And I've been discussing this with a few friends lately as I've gone back to read it, and they've recommended there's some things you should watch in this movie and read the transcript at the same time. It's a movie about what is this life, you know? Is it really a dream? I mean, what is this consciousness? And, you know, for all I know, as it says at the end of that waking life, we may be living in just one moment. And, you know, and everything that goes on for us, even though we think it's a long life with waking up, going to sleep, this and that, years passing, trauma, good things, bad, maybe it's just a simple instant. So I'd recommend that to you if you could get your TV working and get a DVD player on it. You might.
Oh, it's got a DVD player built in it. You know, like neat package, no wires to connect. You know.
You remember Waking Life and The Fountain, and I think that will at least maybe give you some other things to think about. The things we've been talking about, but by people who are very deep and know what they're saying from lots of research and experience. And, you know, we should talk again about those things. Because everything we've talked about today has been right along my interest, Gian.
Yeah, it's been a really, really interesting interview. We still have about 10 minutes to go. You know, we haven't really talked about your book a whole lot.
Well, that's okay. I think we've talked about the concepts in the book, and that's what's important. You know, that book, you know, someone goes to that website, they can see a chapter summary and decide if it's something they want to read, but at least what we've brought out are things that should be of interest to us all. We've talked about what? Life after death. We've talked about illness and healing. We've talked about love, and then we're concluding by something which you've been interested in, and I've, for some reason, had a long interest in, and that's this business of aliens, UFOs, and so forth. So maybe that'd be an appropriate place to finish up.
Yeah, you know, actually the paranormal and the alien thing has been hand in hand with me for my entire life. I can remember as a child in the summer we would lay out on the lawn with my mother, and she would show us what satellites look like in the sky and jets and airplanes, and there's a UFO, okay? And, you know, it was just matter of fact. You know, I remember, now I forgot his name, the guy who wrote about ancient astronauts. Now, I know a lot of his stuff has been discredited since
yeah,
then.
Eric von Däniken or whatever, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, von Däniken?
Yeah, and
Eric von Däniken.
To the public eye again, you know, that book he wrote, Chariot of the Gods, has been a long studied book, and he's written others, but that was the great testimony, and I think there's going to be a new special coming up shortly about that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and...
That I would say was probably my introduction to serious, you know, books about on the topic, you know, and as a teenager was reading Eric von Däniken's books, and it made you think.
Yeah, well, when you think about those Nazca lines and stuff, you know, you'd have to think, well, what is going on? And when you think about easy things like the pyramids in Egypt and other places, you know, and how they could be built, and on and on and on. You've got to realize that it looks like someone had helped the Dogon tribe of Mali. Think about how their huts are built, looking a little bit like these spaceship cones, and how they knew about Sirius being a double star system way before any missionaries were reported to have been in the area, and way before telescopes had the power to resolve this into a double star system, and yet they had diagrams that described this, and they celebrated this revolution, rotation of the star. I mean, every 50 years they had a celebration. So it looks like there have been teachers here, and the question is, was this planet seeded by an extragalactic civilization?
And then you look at the stories of the Hopi about, you know, they've been to this world and that world. There's the meteor crater not far from the Hopi Mesas. They have a kachina associated with the crater,
yeah.
And it's called Star Chaser. How did they know it was made by something? There weren't any people at all in North America when that impact occurred.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that the Hopi Indians that also on some plateaus in Arizona had their cities laid out in according to the Orion constellation, the stars in Orion?
About that, I can't say A or nay. I know they live on mesas. but I don't know whether or not that's true or not.
I don't recall the author, but there's a recent book about that, explaining that and how it kind of parallels what they say about the pyramids in Egypt, supposed to represent the location of the stars and Orion's belt and so forth. But Egypt wasn't the only culture that thought something was special about that Orion constellation in the belt. And I think it's kind of special, too, because I write about that a little bit. But, you know, I think for sure, you know, we've had help from other civilizations. Now, the question is, and everyone wants to know, are there aliens among us now, or is this something that happened way back and just left us to evolve?
You know, I guess so many things say that we did not evolve naturally on this planet. You know, when you look at the archaeological evidence for the horse, okay, you see how the horse evolved. We don't have examples of Eohippus still running around. We have the horse. And so if we evolved from monkeys, why do we, or from apes, why do we still have apes?
That's a good question. It seems like I heard that one, but that's a good one. You're right. But
it makes you wonder, well, you know, if when other animals evolve, because evolution makes sense, you know, on that level, if you watch their evolution, you have archaeological evidence, you know, showing how they evolved, their ancestors, as the new model came out, died out.
Yeah.
So why is the original model for humans still here?
Well, we're going to be dying out, too. It's just a matter of time. You know, maybe a couple of dinosaurs talked about this one day before that thing hit. I don't know what to tell you, except eventually, too, this universe is going to die out at a frozen halt. You know, the solar system has about another, you know, a few billion years at the most to go, because the sun will eventually turn into a red giant. It will expand out to perhaps the orbit of Jupiter and just fry everything, including us, or what's here, and then condense into the stage of a white dwarf. And then everything will just kind of come to a frozen halt. So we've got to make hay while the sun shines, in other words. And
Yeah.
I don't know about these aliens among us. I don't know. I told you I've been married four times, but three times I wonder about that.
About aliens?
Well, I wonder about the mothers-in-law, but I shouldn't crack any.
I could get you in trouble, you know, attract bad karma,
But it was a learning experience, and I learned. And what I learned was that we're all the same. We're all really one. We've got to treat every individual and everything just the way we want to be treated. And who knows, the way this thing works, and as complicated as it is, you know, you may have been my mother at one time, and how could I treat you badly or anybody that I come across with that in mind? So we've got to
work together. Yeah, because how many times do you meet somebody and you feel like you know them? From the minute you first meet them,
well,
you feel like you know them.
That's the saying, you know, strangers are just part of our family we have, we're just meeting, or we have yet to meet. And we're all connected, and we're all connected by these kind of spiritual cords. The Hawaiians call them Aka cords, but they're spiritual cords, stronger in families, and we're all one. We just got to help each other get through this in the best possible manner. That's what I think.
Yeah, that's it. You know, there again, it kind of boils down to live in the minute and don't waste your time, because we don't have all the time in the world to waste.
Nope, that's true. That's true. We're only here for a moment. Just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, kind of an analogy that I used, used to think about all the time was, what does a caterpillar think when it goes into the pupa stage before it becomes a butterfly? Does it think it died?
Yeah, that's probably, you know, a good thought. I mean, that's what a lot of people seem to think. And then you know, they may find it's absolutely beautiful if they've been doing the right thing and learning the lesson.
Yeah. But, you know what, we are fresh out of time.
Well, it's been great. It's been like talking to myself, Gina.
I'm sorry.
It's been great.
Oh, well, interviews are supposed to, you know, be, I don't know, I actually say I really don't interview people. We just have a conversation.
Yes. Well, we had a good one. I enjoyed talking to you about the... We're interested in a lot of the same things, and it's strange how we're looking at these things the same way, pretty much, except for the movies. So I would recommend, again, The Fountain and Waking Life.
Okay. Well, with that, folks, we are out of time. I want to thank Dr. John L. Turner for joining us tonight and being such a fascinating guest. I enjoyed this program immensely, and I hope all of you have too, as well as having found it provided more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week with Michael Schwartz, author of Health and Disease Symbology Handbook. Did I miss it? It promises to be another enlightening and fascinating program. With that, we're out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.